Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the Retro Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and always looking for your next read, then join us. Welcome to the Retro Next podcast. Today, we have published author Alexis Hall. In this interview, we chat about Alexis' writing process, the latest book, Boyfriend Material, and of course, around book recommendations. Now, let's go to an interview. Hi, Alexis. Welcome to the Retro Next podcast.
Hi, it's lovely to be here.
So happy to have you here. Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm very British, so I kind of hate talking about myself, but I'll try. So I'm sort of a cartoon Englishman in that I live very quietly in a little house in England. I drink a lot of tea. Sort of keep myself to myself, really. I grumble about the weather a lot.
I grumble about the weather too, and I'm not English, so it's okay. So what inspired you to become a writer?
I'm going to be a terrible guest here, and there's a lot of the time my response to questions will be, well, that's not quite the question I'm going to answer. One of the things I sort of don't believe in is inspiration. One of the things I'm really keen on with writing is, or one of the other ones I really dislike with writing, is the mystification of the process. Mm-hmm. It's really important to me that I view writing as a job. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and this is something I think it's really important to realize that writing something can be accessible to everyone, and you don't need a calling or a vocation or an inspiration to do it. It's something I've always been vaguely interested in, just because it's a thing that I've always thought I might potentially be good at. So, you know, I've always read books, and you know, I've also always used buses. I know what to be a bus driver. There's not a big inspiration story. It's more a question of just sitting down and saying, actually, I think there's an opportunity here for me to potentially do that, and it might work for me. It's not a big mystery.
I like it. I like the fact it's a job, and that you happen to be really good at it, and you might as well just keep doing it.
That is the plan for the foreseeable, at least.
So what was your journey to get your first book published?
So this is back in about 2000 and I want to say 2012, although my memory for dates, names and times is awful. And the other thing I will say is that this is going to be irrelevant to anyone working in the present day, because this things change so fast in publishing, as I'm sure people who follow this podcast know. So back in the day, I think 2012 is the day is really depressing to me. But back in 2012, self-publishing was very big. There were a lot of small boutique presses cropping up, and I was seeing a lot of open calls. And I thought to myself, well, if this is something I want to have a go at, that's probably a sensible way into it. So I replied to an open call with a boutique press for steampunk fiction. And I submitted a story to them that was Prosperity, which has since come out. But they very nicely came back to me and said, we think this is amazing, but we can't use it. But they had another open call out for lesbian fiction. And one of the things that I'd always wanted to do was a queer take on the kind of the Anita Blakey Girls and Vampires-y kind of sort of the True Blood Vampire Diaries kind of mm-hmm. protagonist that all supernatural beings want to bang. So I wrote KK, Paranormal Investigator, and pitched that to them, and they picked that up instead. And from there, I did a bunch of other things and have been doing a bunch of other things for actually a terrifyingly long time now, actually. So I started in boutique, moved over to bigger publishers, eventually got into print last year.
That's fantastic. So I love it. So let's talk about your writing. Do you follow Adeline or do you see where the story leads you?
Warning, this is going to be another reframing the question. So just because of the nature of where I am publishing, I will always have an outline, because you need an outline to sell a book. Mm-hmm. I tend to work fairly loosely, but I think one of the things that, because you get the are you a plotter or a planter, you get the are you a plotter or a panter question a lot, and I think because I tend to, I really value the work that editors do, and to me, I always find that that question undervalues the importance of second drafts. Mm-hmm. So my first draft will, there'll be a loose outline. I'll work through very much feeling my way. I'll want to know because I'll have an idea of where things are going, mm-hmm. but I won't have a strong sense I'll have an idea of where things are going, but very often you'll get to a point and you'll be like, well, the direction I thought this was going is not a direction it makes sense for it to be going now I've seen what's on the page. Mm-hmm. And so that will go that way. But then what very often happens is something comes back from the editor and they'll say, you know, can you change the ending? Or this bit's not working? Or can you change the middle? And I tend to edit quite in depth. So very often my response to the ending not quite working is to rewrite the middle, because often that's what's making the ending not work. Mm-hmm. So what I mostly write based on is the previous draft, I think, mm-hmm. is the best way to put it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think that's a really great way to look at it, that you're working the story through different drafts, just refining it, just putting different spins and different things to it to make the story stronger.
That's good.
All right. So how do you organize yourself as a writer? How do you keep track of ideas, inspirations, and characters?
Partly I don't. But partly I've got a planner, like, you know, Blake, you can get like your nice funky planners on the internet, and then they have like illustrations and places to put stickers in and tick boxes and things like that. And I use that a lot for just keeping myself organized, managing word count, for things like actually keeping track of. So ideas, again, one of the things I'm a bit heretical about is I don't think ideas are particularly important. I don't think ideas are 10 a penny. I'm always going to have more ideas than I can ever physically put on paper. For keeping track of details, which are the things that you do need to be kept track of, I'll usually have like a space at the back of, like, often in a planner, there'll be like a blank page for notes at the end of the month, and I'll usually whenever I start on the book, I'll usually sign the last page in the month to just doing very basic notes. And that's usually for things that are a bit tangled, or where there's, it'll often be if there's a scene that has a lot of characters in it all at once, or I have to do a lot of supporting cast. So there's a scene in Boyfriend Material where they go to a party with a bunch of Oliver's friends, and that's a bunch of couples, all of whom are married and all of whom have jobs and things. And I had to keep a list there of who everyone is and who's married to whom. And sometimes I'll just grab a piece of A4 paper and just doodle notes on it. There was a complex wibbly wobbly tiny wimey plot in the fantasy novel that I had come out last year, which I needed to draw several diagrams with loops on to explain how that came out. So I sort of have disorganized organizations, for a better thing. It's kind of very loosely controlled chaos.
Yeah, I understand. As someone who likes a chaotic organization, I completely appreciate the fact that it doesn't have to be Excel spreadsheets and all those different Pinterest boards and all those different things. You can just be, you know, doodling around or just making lists or just seeing what, you know, just figure out the system that works for you. Mm-hmm. So do you share your work along the way? Do you wait till others to read?
Sort of varies. I don't have betas or anything like that. I'll often send snippets to my editor to see what she thinks of things. To my agent. Blah, brain not working. To see what she thinks. See if a scene's working. Or particularly because I am. Because most of my books are only published in America. At least bound ones are in print. Are currently only in print in America. The digital ones obviously are available everywhere, but America's a big market, and sometimes I'll need to get a sense of what works for an American audience, because we you know, have the whole separated by common language thing. So there'll be little things that I'll occasionally say, is this working? Is this too annoying? Does this at all make sense to you? But mostly it just goes to the editor when it's done, and I work from there.
Okay. Let's talk about Boyfriend Material. What was the source of inspiration? Where did you get the idea of writing the story?
Mostly from, really specifically from things Richard Curtis did in the 1990s. I noticed that rom-com was getting big. One of the things I like to do, and I've done a lot throughout my career, is do takes on either big popular genres or genres that I personally happen to like. And it happened that I both like rom-coms and that rom-coms were kind of going off notice at the moment. And I really wanted to do something that felt like a sitcom or movie written by Richard Curtis in the 1990s. So that kind of... that kind of Notting Hill Love Actually, kind of anything with Hugh Grant in it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
With a touch of Vicar of Dibley on the side.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it. I think it was like a perfect rom-com for me. It had enough comedy, it had enough, you know, kind of like opposites attract, fake relationship. It just had a little bit of the elements that I like about it that I just want to keep reading in my experience.
I'm so glad.
So Luke and Oliver are opposites attract, and they each have their baggage. They start fake dating. Why pick this trope as the rom-com as opposed to other tropes?
And part of it is the sort of, if you're picking from a list of N things, you're going to have to pick one of them. But there were a couple of quite big fake dating books at the time. And one of the things that I said, that I think I've mentioned, is that I like to do takes on things that are already out there. So, for example, I've just finished a trilogy of Build On books about, you know, a billionaire who's, you know, a dom, because obviously that was quite big in the wake of 50, and there are a lot of takes on that. And so fake dating was the thing that I was noticing, and so I... what I'll often do is I'll take that trope and then work back from it. So all of the other aspects, the opposites attract stuff, the characters, a lot of baggage, that just grew out of how can I make fake dating work in this context for these people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it worked. Like, it was something they'd like each other, but they were not, I don't know, they felt like it was like fake dating was the right way to get them together, as opposed to just being like, we like each other, we're opposites attract, we're just gonna make this work. Like,
yeah.
I think it made the story make sense for their relationship to start, and for them to, even though they were fake dating, to start real dating. I think it just evolved like the whole process.
Yeah.
So I saw the part of I love the text messaging and like Oliver's awkwardness around it, you know, around the dick pics. I think you had a unique take. I'm like, what was inspired you just to add that kind of like humor of saying, you know, I'm going to send you a bunch of pictures of Richards as opposed to of my dick.
So partly I'm far too British to ever possibly consider sending a picture of anything of that nature to anyone, and partly because I just love puns, basically. I just really, really like puns. Part of it's about just the whole, it was about managing the whole sort of, or what's in some areas of trade is called the heat level of the novel. It was never going to be the kind of thing where you'd get pictures of penises flying around.
Yeah.
But I liked it as banter. But it evolved out of banter between the characters, and I liked silly jokes, and the book is full of quite silly jokes and pictures of guys called Richard. I just thought was it appeals to my sense of humour, and because I wrote a lot of it to please myself, it therefore appeals to the sense of humour of the characters. I think it also illuminates. Obviously, it illuminates quite a lot about who they are, because there's no way Oliver is far too repressed to send an actual dick pic. And also, let's be clear, not wanting to send people dick pics doesn't automatically make you repressed, at least not in a bad way. Like, it's a thing you can do if you're into it. You don't have to be into it. But he's the kind of person that would want to do something that showed that created a connection, that showed sort of willing and a slightly clever, slight cleverness in having a workaround. Luke obviously has a lot more of a... Luke's obviously from a more casual background about that kind of thing, although that's something he has difficulty with and baggage around, and so it's also something he responds quite positively to. So it's it's about marrying together, with everything in any kind of fiction, really, it's about marrying together the sort of the in the moment jokiness of it with broader character illustration, I think.
Yeah, it makes sense. And it just, it felt right. Like for me, it made sense for Oliver to do it and for Luke to be like, oh, this is funny, you know, like to realizing like it's just, it make the relationship kind of like tick. So one thing I noticed and throughout the book, you touch upon homophobia from the workplace, family, and just in general. Why was it important to showcase this in this book in a rom-com that you normally wouldn't see?
Interesting. Partly, again, I'm doing this a lot, I'm sorry. To reason, I don't think I felt it was important to specifically. And actually, one of the things that's really, really important to me as someone who writes queer literature is that I think you should be very sparing about when you go to the homophobia world. I think it's really, should is not the right word. I personally prefer to be sparing about going to the homophobia world. I think it's really important that there exist queer stories that aren't about dealing with homophobia, because then otherwise all queer stories are about the same thing. And that creates a very one-dimensional narrative. I think actually it comes back to the idea of working from the trope and wanting to provide a context in which the trope makes sense. Romance tropes in general, because romance is by default, is a very gendered genre. Romance tropes themselves are quite gendered, and so a lot of the ways that fake dating usually works is it's very often, you know, I am a single woman, I need a date for this event so that people won't think that I'm a tragic spinster, roughly. And you can't really gender flip that because, and again, this gets very, very complicated, and I'm very aware that I don't want to mansplain things. But the pressures to be in relationships that men are under are different from the pressures to be in relationships that women are under. And therefore, that setup of fake dating doesn't really work. So I needed something that made sense for a queer book. And one of the things that I do come back to a lot in my writing is what you might call identity policing. Right back to sort of Little Lamb, one of my first books, there's a I often come back to characters who are in different ways sort of looked down upon for the way in which they choose to live their identity. One of the things I think is interesting, but saying about my own book makes me sound like an awful person, at least if you're British and therefore congenitally self-deprecating. One of the things I wanted to do actually was to highlight that both Oliver and Luke in their own way have a difficult relationship between the way they choose to inhabit their identity and the way society expects them to. So Luke, because he's been quite wild, partly from which he's come from a bad place, but also partly because people are allowed to be wild, it's no one's business but his, brushes up against the edge of society that is scared of that style of expression and that type of lifestyle, and so feels a strong pressure to get a respectable boyfriend. Meanwhile, Oliver isn't particularly interested in queer culture at all. All his friends are straight. He sometimes feels quite alienated from the assumption that because he's gay, he's got to be interested in gay things. And the whole thing I wanted to get across, and again, it's part of the opposite track thing, but partly it's a way of setting up the fake dating framing, is it's really important you don't have to be either of those guys. You can be neither of those guys or both of those guys, or like, there's no right way to be you, really. So in a sense, it's more about identity than about specifically addressing homophobia as a specific thing, although I'm a massive Barthian, so that's just my interpretation, and readers are happy to read things how they wish.
Yeah, I think it just did all the characters really well. Like, it explained why there were the decisions they made and like how they go about living their life and how they actually come together as a relationship. So I think it was like a really, it was a well-rounded way of looking at the situation.
Thank you.
So Luke is the son of aging rock stars who, after an encounter with the press, he basically let his life fall apart. Like, What was important to demonstrate the world of press and how it affects Luke's perception of who he is?
There's going to be another one where the answer is, oh God, I say a priori versus a posteriori. It makes me sound incredibly silly, so I apologize for that. But it wasn't a priori important. It wasn't that I sat down saying, I want to write a book that deals with the press, because, yeah. I mean, partly because it's just, I mean, it's a rom-com. What I wanted to write was a book that was funny and heartwarming about two guys fake dating. But again, building backwards from the trope, we had, my thought process was essentially, fake dating. Okay, what kind of person would need a fake boyfriend? Okay, what if it was someone who needed to kind of rehabilitate their image? Okay, so why might you need to rehabilitate your image? Okay, well, maybe you've had some kind of contact, some kind of negative press coverage, and that, so you're probably like tangentially famous for some reason, and that then came to, well, you're probably like a famous person's kid or something.
Mm-hmm. I love it. That makes sense. It makes sense why you've got to recap your image to bring a fake boyfriend into your life. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So speaking of Luke, he works in a dung beetle charity cause. Is that a real charity cause, yeah, or is it made up?
Yes and no is the answer. It's not based on a specific real charity, and I don't know if there are any specific real charities that just do dung beetles, but I do just peripheral. You know how things just filter, particularly in the modern hyper-connected internet age, things just filter into your brain as things that are things. I do know that dung beetles are a really important part of the ecosystem. They are actually, I don't think they're endangered in the technical sense of the world, but they are threatened, and it is genuinely potentially going to cause quite major problems down the line. So there are people who are specifically working on saving dung beetles. It's there's also a broader thing with I think about charity quite a lot. There's also a broader thing where it's very easy to attract attention to kind of sexy causes.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a real problem with drawing attention to unsexy causes like saving dung beetles. So it's like there's a British naturalist called Chris Packham, who presented a kids TV show in the 80s and 90s. You've almost certainly never heard of him, and he caused a massive uproar about like 5-10 years ago now by suggesting we should let pandas go extinct. But the point he was making was that we put a lot of effort into flagship species, we put a lot of effort into saving animals that look cool or cute or have had movies or cartoons made about them, but actually ecologically often what's really important is things like saving dung beetles. So there's sort of real environmental science behind it. I don't know if it's a real, it's not based on a specific real organization.
It's a good you brought a good reminder about unsexy causes. And mm-hmm. just realizing, like, you know, you still have to take care of it. Like, I think it's someone who we're in this time of the year, we're in this time of the world where some causes are becoming more prevalent, and then realizing, well, there's all the other causes that are struggling with, yeah, and that we should take care of them too. You know, as best as
possible. Yeah. So, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Of course, then that can lead to paralysis, and you want to. I'm thinking, well, if you can't do everything, because you don't want to get into the space where you're thinking, well, if we can't do everything, we couldn't do anything, shouldn't do anything. And yes, is it? Charity is complex. It's incredibly complex.
It is. So, all right. So let's talk about Oliver. Oliver practices criminal law. What was your research to get this part right and demonstrate that's different from American TV? Keeping in mind that most of the American audience are be like, wait, there's conversations about jury trials and criminal law that's different, because the book is set in England.
Yes, so it's worth recognizing that. It is worth recognizing that most English people also only really know about the law from American TV. It's like, it's why the part of the reason there is that that Oliver and Luke have those conversations where Luke's just kind of, why don't you shout objection? Is it's not, it's genuinely not just trying to make it accessible to an American audience, just genuinely. The only time you see that kind of thing is when you're watching, you know, Law and Order or Ally McBeal. And so you do just internalize this idea that it's all lawyers shouting at each other. And even though we know rationally that we live in a country where lawyers wear wigs, and obviously biggest difference, wear wigs in my country. As for research, so partly just because I went to one of the ancient scary universities, I know a reasonable number of barristers. It's one of the jobs that people do in my social circle. So I've had a reasonable number of just kind of lawyer conversations with people. Part of it also is I've got books. There's quite a lot of books by lawyers. There's one called The Secret Barrister is quite a good one. Of just people doing anecdotes about being in the law, which is, it's one of those odd ones where I don't know how much of the difference between the way Oliver talks about the law in Boyfriend Material and the way that Luke thinks about the law and the way that American TV presents the law is due to differences between the American and British legal system, or whether it's due to differences between TV and reality, if you see what I mean. So for example, there's one of the things that they talk about a lot is expansion of the right to jury trial, which is a thing that I've just cropped up in my research as a thing that some British lawyers are interested in. But I think it's a thing American lawyers are interested in as well, because not everything is, as far as I know, not everything is done by jury in America either. You tend to think of it that way because you tend to think of jury trial of trials as being two guys in nice suits talking to each other in front of a jury, and for some reason the case is always directly related to their personal lives. But I think it's just that if you look at what being a lawyer is like from the perspective of actual real-world legal professionals, it's just always not a lot like TV.
Yeah, I don't think, I think there's judge trials, there are trials where the judge is the one who makes the decision. And then being a lawyer doesn't mean that you're always going to be in trial. Like, I know plenty of lawyers who are never set their foot in the courthouse. So I think it's, you know, it's important to, I think it just expanded the conversation. As someone who's like had no idea about the British, you know, legal system, it was it definitely added a new layer of understanding that I just didn't think it was.
That's very kind of you. As always, I would stress, as the old disclaimer goes, I am not a lawyer, and please don't learn too much about the British legal system from me, because I probably got a lot of it wrong. But it's one of the things I try. I have glib phrases I articulate to myself, and one of the things I think is that I care a lot about specificity rather than authenticity. Yeah. Say that again. I care quite a lot about specificity rather than authenticity. I think what was really important to me was that Oliver's being a criminal barrister in England came across as not just being a generic TV lawyer, but as really specifically being a criminal barrister in England. It's part of the reason he talks a lot about not making any money, because and this definitely is true on the other side of the Atlantic. I have watched YouTube videos about this, criminal law does not pay, because most people who are on trial for crimes are poor.
Yeah. Thank you so much for talking about the book. So now let's go to random book recommendations. This is an opportunity to share with the audience what they should read next. So what is your favorite genre?
Ooh, so again, this is I'm saying I'm about interviewee a lot, and I apologize for that, but I have real difficulty with favorites, because I think I have a hierarchical mind, which again, I keep saying things and thinking, gosh, that makes you sound like a dickhead. So I apologize. I read across genres. So I read fantasy, I read romance, I read mysteries a lot. I read occasional bits of literary fiction, although, and you can, the debate of whether literary fiction counts as a genre or not is very much up in the air. The only genre I really avoid, I think, is horror, just because I don't particularly like being scared in my leisure time. And I don't super get on with some kinds of very hard SF, if it's all just kind of, you know, machines and space marines. Otherwise, I'm very genre eclectic.
Okay. Who are your go-to authors?
So again, I have an imperial buttload, to use a technical term. I've done a whole, last year about Terry Pratchett, who was very important to me at a very young age. In romance, I love the work of Laura Kinsale. She just writes in a way that I don't think anyone else in the genre does, or really anyone else anywhere does. I'm a big fan of Dashiell Hammett, if only because if you're going to read books about private detectives, read books about private detectives that were written by someone that used to be a private detective. I am incredibly into Nalini Singh's very weird paranormal romance stuff that she, I think, has stopped doing that. She's moved more towards more contemporary, but her old sort of Side Changeling series and some of her other very, very weird, like intensely world-built stuff, I always thought was excellent. I also really like Wilkie Collins and think he needs more bigging up because Dickens gets all the press and shouldn't.
So what has been a book that you read this year or last year that you love?
Once again, I'm really bad at keeping to limits, so I'm going to mention a couple if that's all right. Yeah. So I really enjoyed... So I really enjoyed Planetfall by Emma Newman, which is a we shared an editor, which is how I'll copy the book. It's a science fiction story about someone. Again, we talk about unsexy charities, and it's a science fiction story that's basically about someone with an unsexy mental illness, who was a 3D printer technician. Living in the shadow of an alien city that might also be God in the future. I recently really enjoyed The Five by Harry Rubenhold, which is a non-fiction biography of the five women who were killed by Jack the Ripper, which sounds really morbid and exploitative, but kind of the point is sort of to address the morbidness and exploitativeness of the whole Jack the Ripper thing. So it's about taking those five women and treating them seriously as human beings and trying to address some of the myths about the way they've been presented over the years, things like that, trying to humanize them to sort of remind the world that these were real human beings who got murdered, although one of the things the book does quite importantly is that it doesn't have any detail about the murders, you know, right up to the night before they died, and then it's, you know, then Jack the Ripper happened. Which I think is quite an... It's one that I don't like declaring books to be important, but I think as a particularly in a world where true crime is so big now as a genre, particularly a sort of televised genre, I think something that goes back to probably the most famous true crime story in history and recasts it as being about the victims, I think is really important. Mm-hmm. The final one, which is a book I genuinely read recently and genuinely loved and... would be nice to tell people about is A Recipe for Persuasion by Sonali Dev, which isn't strictly out yet. It comes out on the 26th of May, so it might be out when this goes live. I have no idea what the timescales are on these things. And that's a retelling of Persuasion, but it's about an Indian-American woman living in California, who runs a restaurant that she inherited from her father, who she sort of has this very complicated retroactive relationship with. You sort of gradually learn over the book that he's nowhere near as benevolent a person as you sort of suspect he might have been from the beginning. Ticks all my boxes is a dismissive way of putting it, but there's so much about that book that I think is great because it's I love retellings, and I particularly love retellings that pull out something different from the core story. So this takes the core framing of Persuasion and makes it about a woman who runs a restaurant and a professional footballer, that's a professional soccer player to Americans. Also, I really respect the fact that it consistently uses the term football whenever anyone who's not American is talking about it, because we call it football. One of the things I really like in romance, something I try to do myself, is not to overly centralize the central relationship. And obviously, that's a bit weird for romance. It's like having a fantasy novel that doesn't centralize the magic and secondary world stuff. But I think to me it's really important that to recognize that while romantic love is great, friends are cool too. It's why there's so much stuff. Well, this is part of the reason there's so much stuff with Luke's friends and all of his friends in boyfriend material, for example. And And so an awful lot of Recipe for Persuasion is just about the protagonist's relationship with her mother, her mother's relationship with, well, with the protagonist's father, her ex-husband, and it's very layered. It's sort of goes to a strong sort of almost family drama vibe to it. It does a lot of things I think are really great. And it is Jamie Romance, obviously that's the genre I'm most associated with. It's really good. Sorry, I should probably have come up with a punchier ending for that.
So tell us where we can find you online.
This is the bit where I make everyone who works in marketing at any of my publishers really annoyed, because you can find me online at www.quinquavolt.com. It's from the Athanasian Creed. It's something like Quinquae Vault Salve Est, which means whoever wants to be saved shall be saved. It was also then the first two words of that, Quinquae Vault, and were a euphemism for prostitution in the 17th century, because it just means whoever wants to. So that's, I'm just going to make sure I've got the spelling right now. It's quinquavevult.com or at Quinquae Vault on Twitter. I think that's largely, all the other details will be on my, I'll be on the website. And of course, again, if you want to follow me reading Moby Dick a chapter a day and sending silly tweets about it, then you can look for the hashtag quarantine me Ishmael. There are also people who are smarter and funnier than me doing the same thing. So,
I love it. Thank you so much for being on the show.
No, there's no problem at all. Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share with friends, subscribe, or rate and review the show. This is the easiest way to support this podcast. Want to join a romance loving community? Want weekly book recommendations, monthly author Q&As, and book recommendation meetups? Make new friends? Then join our Patreon community. To sign up, please follow the links in the show notes. What to Read Next podcast is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts to love on frolic.media/podcast. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyoureadnextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.